Hello, I am Randy Andrews, and today I'll be discussing the 1983 classic film, War Games. I'll be talking about the cast, the technical aspects of the real compared to the not-so-real aspects of the film, the background, and the neat soundtrack by Arthur B. Rubinstein. That's all today on Soundtrack Alley. So today, I'll be getting us into War Games with Matthew Broderick and Dabney Coleman. So let's talk about some of the cast.
You're really into computers, huh?
Yeah.
What are you doing?
Dialing into the school's computer. They change the password every couple of weeks, but I know where they write it down.
The studio had the Galaxian from 1979 and Galaga from 1981 arcade machines delivered to Matthew Broderick's home, where he practiced for 2 months to prepare for the arcade scene. The computer in David's room is actually an IMSAI 880. And the person who supplied the computer for the film tells how Matthew Broderick saved a shooting day by figuring out a programming sequence for the keyboard on his own after the instructions were lost. There's also a scene where Matthew Broderick is picked up by the FBI, and it was filmed at a 7-Eleven in Big Bear, California. That 7-Eleven and the State Farm Insurance Agency next door are still there 30 years later. Barry Corbin, he ad-libbed most of his lines in the movie. The part of Professor Falcon was originally written with the idea of John Lennon playing the part. I could totally see that. According to John Badham, who is the director, Matthew Broderick and Ally Sheedy were stiff as boards when they came in onto the soundstage, having both Martin Brest's dark vision and the idea that they would soon be fired. Badham did 12 to 14 takes of the first shot to loosen the actors up. At one point, Badham decided to have a race with the two actors around the soundstage, with the one who came last having to sing a song to the crew. Badham lost and sang The Happy Wanderer, the silliest song he could think of. Matthew Broderick's character hacks into his high school computer to change his grade. His character in Ferris Bueller's Day Off does the same, although his purpose was to change his attendance record rather than his grades. David Lightman was inspired by a real-life hacker, David Scott Lewis. Lewis isn't allowed to discuss whether he ever hacked into a military computer. That also makes sense. Falcon's home was built on a soundstage at MGM Studios. Most of the set pieces are from Little House on the Prairie and old dinosaur movies. When David comes home the day after the NORAD computer break-in, the newscaster on the television is talking about a prophylactic recycling center, which is kind of weird. Matthew Broderick would work with John Wood and Dabney Coleman again. Wood in Lady Hawk, and then Coleman in Inspector Gadget. As in Matthew Broderick's movie Ferris Bueller's Day Off, both mothers are real estate agents. The name Joshua is the same as that of the computerized mobile mechanical arm in Demon Seed, which was in 1977. Jennifer and David ride a Derby variant moped. It's a Spanish motor scooter, which makes sense. Ally Sheedy auditioned for the role of Jennifer for 4 months before being cast for it. At the end, when Joshua says, "How about a nice game of chess?" the lights come up. The cut right after you see David and Jennifer show the war room as viewed from the front of the room. At the back of the room, the entire row of computers and electronic equipment lights up for about half a second and then all go off while the rest of the equipment in the room remains on. Clearly, switching that group on tripped a circuit breaker for those props alone. When McKittrick is showing David around the war room, David asks him about working with Professor Falcon. "He must have been pretty amazing, huh?" referring to Falcon in the past tense because Falcon is officially dead. McKittrick replies in the present tense, "Well, he's a brilliant man, a little flaky, revealing, if you catch it, that Falcon is not dead." When Falcon starts the film for David and Jennifer, he uses the phrase, "Are you sitting comfortably? Then I'll begin." This was the beginning line from Listen with Mother, a BBC radio program for children, which ran between 1950 and 1982. It's likely that Falcon's son Joshua would have listened to this program. Now let's get into things regarding the director, John Badham.
I thought that the story was very powerful and said something about possibly one of the most important issues of the 80s, if not the whole of history, dealing with nuclear technology. The fun part of it is that the idea that a 17-year-old computer genius could somehow interface his computer with the Pentagon's defense computer and think he's playing a video game and suddenly almost start World War III.
John Badham recorded voice on the pocket tape recorder in the infirmary and dubbing John Wood's voice in the helicopter scene. When John Badham took over as director, he changed the photographic process. It's possible to see changes in the frame lines between the old and the new footage. The NORAD Command Center built for the movie was the most expensive set ever constructed up to that time, built at the cost of $1 million. The producers were not allowed into the actual NORAD Command Center, so they had to imagine what it was like. In the DVD commentary, director John Badham notes that the actual NORAD Command Center isn't nearly as elaborate as the one in the movie. He refers to the movie set as NORAD's wet dream of itself. According to John Badham's, the scene of the Jeep trying to crash through the gate at NORAD and turning over was an actual accident. The Jeep was supposed to continue through the gate. They added the scene of the characters running from the Jeep and down the tunnel and used the botched Jeep stunt. When David makes a joke directed at his teacher about asexual reproduction, the laughter heard afterwards is considered to be the rest of the kids in the classroom. But John Badham said that some of the crew didn't know the punchline and laughed out loud during the scene. That laughter was left in the soundtrack, and if you listen closely, you will hear what is clearly adults laughing out loud rather than classroom snickering. In the director's commentary, one of the writers says that the writers got the DEFCON numbers wrong in the movie. In the movie, DEFCON 5 is peace, while DEFCON 1 is war. The person doing the commentary is actually wrong about the movie getting DEFCON wrong. DEFCON 5 is indeed the peace rating, while DEFCON 1 is the war rating. The delegation from the city of Birmingham, Alabama, visiting NORAD is certainly a tribute to director John Badham's hometown. John Badham wanted the WOPR to have flashing lights to give it personality. And the keyboard, or the keypad lock tones heard when the guard unlocks the infirmary door, are the tones used by touch-tone telephones. The tones heard corresponding to dialing 222-333 on a touch-tone phone. Now let's get into some of the technical aspects of the film.
Yesterday's aim was interrupted, although primary goal has not yet been achieved. Solution is near. Game time elapsed. 31 hours, 12 minutes, 50 seconds. Estimated time remaining, 52 hours, 17 minutes, 10 seconds.
What is the primary goal?
You should know, Professor. You programmed me.
Oh, come on. What is the primary goal?
To win the game.
The WOPR, as seen in the movie, was made of wood and painted with a metal finish paint. As the crew filmed the displays of the WOPR, special effects supervisor Michael L. Fink sat inside and entered the information into an Apple II computer that drove the countdown display. The writer's main inspiration for the character of Professor Stephen Falcon was Cambridge professor Stephen Hawking. Hawking was originally approached to appear in the movie, but he declined because he didn't want the producers exploiting his disability, which is very, very understandable. In February 2006, the New York Times article reported that this movie ended up having a significant effect on President Ronald Reagan's understanding of and policy on telecommunications and computer systems security. Excuse me. And led directly to Reagan pushing the first federal laws intended to outlaw hacking. Reagan saw the movie at Camp David on June 4, 1983. And the next week, while in a meeting with some congressmen and his national security advisors to prepare for Russian arms negotiations, he asked if any of them had seen the movie. When they said they had not, he recounted the plot and then asked Chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, General John Vesey Jr., if someone could really break into our most sensitive computers. Vesey, who didn't know anything about hacking or cybersecurity, asked for a former NSA analyst, Donald Latham, who replied that it was not only possible, but very plausible, since the NSA had already been hacking into China's and the USSR's telecommunications and computer systems for years. Latham had first become acquainted with this danger through his friendship with Willis Ware, a computer scientist at the Rand Corporation. Ware had written a paper in the 1960s about the high likelihood that as the use of shared computer networks increased, so would the risk of those networks being accessed even remotely. Ware, in turn, was also a source for the War Games screenwriters, Lawrence Lasker and Walter Parks, when they wanted to make sure that the plot they were devising for the movie was plausible. They called Rand, which was headquartered close to Lasker's house, and ended up meeting with Ware, who served as a technical consultant for them. The computer seen in the black and white film of Falcon is made up from components of an IBM Combat Direction Central built in 1954 to protect the United States from Soviet bomber attack. It was the largest and heaviest computer system ever built, the full system weighing 6,000 tons and taking up the entire floor of a bomb-proof blockhouse. Components of decommissioned systems were sold for scrap and bought by film and television production companies who wanted futuristic-looking computers, despite the fact that they were built in the 50s. The components used in this film were previously used in The Time Tunnel in 1966 and The Towering Inferno in 1974, among others. When David is having his computer dial random phone numbers in his search for Protovision, the telephone numbers listed on the screen are not of the traditional fake 555 variety. This isn't a problem since the area code is 311, which doesn't exist and will never be used as a real telephone number. This number was set aside by AT&T years ago for special purposes, as was the case for 411 and 911. This movie inspired Congress to create and update the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act of 1984. Representative Dan Glickman opened the proceedings by saying, "Are going to show about 4 minutes from the movie War Games, which outlines the problem fairly clearly. The House committee reported solemnly and intoned, War Games showed a realistic representation of the automatic dialing and access capabilities of the personal computer. The NORAD computer system used 1950s era systems in 1983. After War Games, visitors for the NORAD tour constantly asked to see the modern computer rooms. Partly driven by this, in the coming years, color displays, mostly on Sun workstations, started replacing the much older equipment. Incidentally, NORAD only detected threats. Strategic Air Command, until 1992, handled responses to threats. During their extensive research for the film, writers Lawrence Lasker and Walter Parks made friends with many hackers and security experts. They later wrote Sneakers, another film featuring hackers and security experts, which the score is done by James Horner. The tunnel and exterior used for the entrance into NORAD is the same tunnel used to enter and exit Toontown in Who Framed Roger Rabbit, as well as in the climax of Back to the Future Part 2. The tunnel is located in Griffith Park, Los Angeles, California. This was the first cinematic reference to a firewall, a security measure used in computer networking and internet security. The main NORAD computer center is located at Peterson Air Force Base in Colorado Springs, Colorado. The underground facility portrayed in the film is the Alternate Command Center, which is located in a nuclear bunker deep within the nearby Cheyenne Mountain. At the start of the first NORAD Command Center scene, many of the white springs are visible on the floor. These are the set designer's concept of seismic-based isolation springs, which are a common means of protecting structures from earthquake damage. In the case of the underground NORAD bunker, the springs would isolate some kind of foundation platform from the cave door. Graphics on the large NORAD war room screens were rendered in advance by the HP 9845C desktop computer running BASIC. In 1982, that same thing was comprised of a base with built-in keyboard and a 14-inch color monitor that was mounted on top. The cost was about $90,000, and the entire desktop computer weighed about 100 pounds. The computer's resolution was not good enough to project on a large screen or to be filmed from directly. So, a high-resolution monochromatic display was connected. The images were filmed from the display, one frame at a time, one color at a time, using filters for red, green, and blue. The process took about 1 minute per frame of the film. There was also a video game version of this movie, which made it in 1984 to the Coleco Vision, Commodore 64, and the Atari 8-bit computer. The game started out greeting you as Professor Falcon, and you would play a game of global thermal nuclear war. Your objective was to stop nuclear war from occurring by protecting the country with various military vehicles and weapons as a set time limit without reaching DEFCON 1, which is pretty cool. The computer used to break into NORAD was programmed to make the correct words appear on the screen, no matter which keys were pressed, which is odd. NORAD HQ set was built in the Cascades. The Oregon airport was really Boeing Field, or Goose Island, and it's really Anderson Island in the southern part of Puget Sound, all in Washington State. The last ferry off the island really is at 6:30 p.m., and you really are stuck there if you miss it. The movie is featured as a central plot device in the book Ready Player One by Ernest Cline. Now, this is a key feature for many people that are really interested in the new movie coming out soon this next year, and the protagonist must reenact the movie playing the part of David, line by line, movement by movement, in order to unlock a certain door. Now, in the first scene, Jerry mentions the phrase Om Mani Padme Hum, an ancient Sanskrit mantra. The six syllables remind the speaker of the six Buddhist perfections: generosity, ethics, patience, diligence, renunciation, and wisdom. The huge door in the underground Cheyenne Mountain complex looked very similar to the actual door as seen in a December 1987 media tour. The biggest difference is that it opened the opposite direction. Now, the crew built the command center with 12 giant projector screens. According to Michael Fink, the visual effects supervisor, those kinds of screens didn't exist. And that's something I didn't even know. The original director was Martin Bress, and several of the scenes he shot are still in the movie. He was fired due to creative differences, and he has stated that he took NORAD's control center layout and did a scaled-down version of it for Beverly Hill Cop Police Control Center. That's kind of cool, too. The dual 8-inch floppy drive is an IMSAI-FDC2. The monitor is a 17-inch electro-home. The keyboard is something else. And the 1200 baud modem is a Cermatec 212, relabeled with the name IMSAI. The acoustic coupler prop was added for visual effects only. And you can see how these are really technical aspects of the film. When the message for the tour group in NORAD is activated, the sound effect that plays is actually used in the video game Galaga. It can also be heard if you listen carefully when David is playing the game in the beginning of the movie. WOPR goes through most or more than 150 possible scenarios in the global thermal nuclear war, including Zaire Alliance, Gabon Surprise, and English Thrust. The film is still a favorite in Silicon Valley. In 2008, Google held a 25th anniversary screening of it. At the beginning of the movie, when the Air Force guys are starting their shift, there's an official sign on the wall that reads, "Anyone caught urinating in this area will be discharged," which is kind of funny. The computer name WOPR used in the movie was a joke based on a real computer once used to predict war strategies at NORAD, which was called BRGR. The Burger King Whopper is a burger. The tic-tac-toe scene was used as part of a montage for the hard-to-explain music video by The Strokes, which you can look that up on YouTube. The computer display showing game time elapsed and game time remaining is framed in a bezel with stenciled labels reading GST, TMP, SIM, and TTG. These are standard acronyms used with electronic and other test equipment, respectively. They stand for Ground System Test, Test Evaluation Plan, Scientific Instrumentation Module, and Time to Go. The producers designed the offices with glass windows to show off the expensive command center set. The writers based General Barringer on General James Hardinger. Hardinger was the commander-in-chief of NORAD in the early 1980s. The video game arcade, where David is playing in the early parts of the movie, was located in the southwest corner of Ventura Boulevard and Quaketown Avenue in Woodland Hills, California. That building is now a Chase Bank branch, and the Ryan's restaurant, visible through the arcade building doors, was later renamed to Lyons and is, as of this writing in 2016, an automobile repair shop. The school right next door to the arcade was Taft High School, and that arcade was indeed packed pretty much every day with high school students back when the movie was being filmed. That's pretty awesome. One version of the script had an early version of WOPR named Uncle Ollie, or Ollie Omnipresent Laser Interceptor, a space-based defense laser run by an intelligent program. But this idea was discarded because it was too speculative. Let's see. The actual phone number that David used to call the NORAD WOPR computer was 399-2364. Of course, it's a fake phone number. The infirmary door lock keypad has 16 buttons, with a 6-digit code as audibly signified by as using only 2 of those buttons, each pressed 3 times in succession. There would be only 120 possible combinations. Adding the restriction that they be adjacent to each other, there would be only 24 possible combinations for David to try, and only 12 if they were known to be adjacent horizontally. The computer playing global thermal nuclear war with David is called the WOPR, which is an acronym for War Operation Plan Response. And in the opening scene of the movie, the launch code is a complex amount of letters and numbers. The ProtoVision being located in Sunnyvale, California, may be a tribute to Atari, which installed the first Pong arcade game in Andy Capp's Tavern in Sunnyvale in August 1972. So let's get into some of the score aspects on the film. First, the touchtone sequence to reach the president from NORAD Control Center is the famous da-da-da-dum from Ludwig von Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. These 4 notes are also the letter V in Morse code, used variously as a symbol of victory and peace. Da-da-da-dum-dum, ba-bum, ba-bum, you know. Crosby, Stills, and Nash was submitted for a song for the soundtrack called War Games. That was originally from their album Allies, but was edited out of the film at the last second. However, United Artists still used the video for the song, featuring footage for the film as a promotional video that did receive airplay on MTV, which that's pretty awesome. The code for the lock of the infirmary, as identified as 333-222, matches the tone for the chorus of the 1969 Edwin Starr song, War. What is it good for? A song also covered by Bruce Springsteen and Frankie Goes to Hollywood. The harmonica music was added at the last minute. Composer Arthur B. Rubinstein said it's the only thing fans always remember about the score. Now, with War Games, it's not surprising that the filmmakers involved in this cult favorite couldn't decide what type of movie to make it out of the script. Martin Brest had departed, and so when John Badham took the helm after shooting had begun, he still encouraged lead actor Matthew Broderick and others to on the set to adopt a more casual attitude, reinstalling the lighter atmosphere that the film's comedy genetics seemed to demand. Ultimately, the concept behind War Games was so frighteningly new and realistic that audience viewed it as just another one of the Soviet scare entries of the era. It had mannerisms of a humorous parody of its more serious counterparts, but its anti-war message and exploration of budding technologies at the time gave it the heart of a deadly, serious thriller. Broderick, as playing a high school deviant with poor grades but spectacular hacking skills, and when he accidentally logs into the computer, puts in charge the missile defense systems at NORAD. He activates the computer's simulation mode that depicts an incoming Soviet nuclear attack to the live operators of the system. And so, chaos is ensued. And so with this, while movies showing teenagers brilliantly and comically using technology were popular in the 1980s, War Games struck a far more serious nerve and wowed critics and received 3 Academy Award nominations completely out of the blue, combining with a strong box office success to earn itself a lasting reputation as a movie well beyond its time. Some of the technical concepts conveyed almost in jest in the film had become industry norms, including firewalls and brute force password attacks. When Badham took control of the picture, he brought along his regular composing collaborator, Arthur B. Rubinstein. While Badham's career included work with John Williams and Hans Zimmer, his projects with Rubinstein represented some of the composer's most notable feature films. Although they had come off of Blue Thunder at the time, they were primarily television artists. Rubinstein's career was highlighted by his duo of 1983 feature scores. He was known at the time for his ability to combine synthetic and orchestral sounds, especially in their catering to standard pop culture styling. In many ways, War Games is a display of his wide range of talents, in part because of extraordinary depth of motific development, but also in its highly disparate instrumental ranges. This score is, in short, all over the place in terms of style and tone, caught inescapably in the same dilemma that faced the film as a whole. You can hear Rubinstein's struggle to balance the contemporary tones of the teenager's world with a striking, serious, militaristic angle, the whimsically lyrical Americana side, and the mischievous parody chase material, all sometimes at play in short succession. For the teenage hacker element, the composer goes the route of electronic pop silliness, the ultimate in nearly 1980s cheese that is even less tolerable than most of the looped music for video arcades of the era. The NORAD scenes feature extremely abrasive orchestral rhythmic force, highlighted by relentless layers of percussion and an abnormally large brass section. As the protagonists contemplate nuclear annihilation on the island scenes in the middle of the film, Rubinstein responds with harmonica-led tones of sincerity that remind of Jerry Goldsmith's westerns of the 1960s. The dainty chase material, meanwhile, includes affable woodwind rhythms that have a tad of Williams mischief built into their style, as if these desperate tones of the score don't cause a bit of whiplash. Rubinstein reinforces them with a huge selection of motifs. Broderick's hacker receives two themes, each translated into eerie, highly synthetic song variants performed by the composer's band, The Beepers, early in the score. These simplistic progressions of three or four notes are extremely obnoxious and are barely recognizable when they turn serious in the latter half of the score. The NORAD computer and its creator receive a couple of often intertwined themes, and the more sensitive one for the computer, a lovely piano melody, is too seldom utilized to really appreciate it. So, the aforementioned harmonica theme is translated into the Edge of the World song that is featured prominently and has become the soundtrack's calling card for mainstream viewers. The mischief, military, and action motifs are dutifully pop up in their expected places. The action motif is most interestingly in its brutality in Helicopter Pursuit and Launch Detected and Winner None. Rubinstein is at the top of his game here in the climactic Winner None cue, with the brass lines answering each other in pounding Alan Silvestri fashion to accompany the horrifying scenarios being played out by the computer at the climax. A few singular motifs in the score, such as the Russian choral material in Confidence is High, further fragment its narrative, however, confirming War Games as a truly schizophrenic work. It's not hard to appreciate the technical mastery of in some Rubinstein's highlights, and the Americana theme for Edge of the World is easily digestible, but War Games remains a very challenging score to casually enjoy on album. The early synthetic tones of the lead character and the hacking element are downright insufferable to many when they listen to it. The thematic divisions later are compartmentalized to a great degree, and it's almost as though Rubinstein wrote the score too complex for what the film required, though the indecision about whether to make it lighthearted, a split parody, or completely serious really went right along with what was happening on set. On the album, it took a long time for War Games to be treated properly. The original LP presentation contained the highlights of the score, with dialogue contained in three vocal tracks. Though its only official CD representation for a long time was in a little over 20 minutes on Rubinstein's rare 2-CD promotional set from Supertrax in 1998. In 2008, Entrada Records finally provided the complete score with a couple of bonus tracks that brought the presentation's time to almost 70 minutes. The sound quality on this 2,500 copy release is surprisingly good, though while that clarity enhances the action material, it doesn't do much justice to the pure synthetic portions early in the score. Some strange placement of players in the soundscape will cause stereo oddities in a few places. Overall, though, War Games is among Rubinstein's most respected career works. Given its highly disparate components, it's likely best that you preview the music in context of the highly entertaining movie before exploring the Entrada album blindly. So what we'll do now is play a few tracks or cues from the film. I'll begin with War Games, A New Grade, The Game Begin. This really gives us a feel for our title character as well as the darker path at which he finds himself innocently enough through the computer. So let's play those cues by Arthur Rubinstein. We'll be right back. Next, I'll play a game of chess, Nuclear Alert, Walk Through NORAD, and David Captured. These highlight our senses and really make us feel for the character, but also it gives us the comedic feel to the very real threat that does exist. So let's see how these play out and how Arthur uses them through the score, giving us the overall arching theme.
Thank you.
Sadly, we've come down to another end of Soundtrack Alley. I hope you've enjoyed what I brought to the table today. And so lastly, I'll be playing NORAD, This Could Be War, Helicopter Pursuit and Launch Detected, Joshua, and end credits. So I want to thank you for listening. Thanks to Jillian Orwall for the great intro today. Thanks to all my listeners, and you can check out my show on iTunes and Google Play. It's through SoundtrackAlley.net and SoundtrackAlley.podbean.com. You can find me on Twitter at RandallAndrews1 and email me at SoundtrackAlley@yahoo.com. Also, check me out on Facebook. It's just Soundtrack Alley. And so until next time, happy listening. Thank you. Thank you for listening to Soundtrack Alley, the podcast. I hope you take the time to review my podcast on iTunes or even listen to it on Podbean. With your review, it helps me get noticed on iTunes. Thank you so much. Have a good day. Thank you for listening to Soundtrack Alley Spotlight. If you are on Apple Podcasts, please rate and review the show. Also, if you want to leave a comment, question, or concern, please email me at soundtrackalley@gmail.com and enjoy looking at my blog at soundtrackalley.com.